Natalia fell asleep in his arms. For some reason, they left him his watch, and periodically he glanced at the Rolex. The time so far spent in the submarine's brig was slightly over 2 hours. There was a toilet in the far corner by the bulkhead. He debated the possibility of cannibalizing it to somehow short-circuit the electrical barrier that kept them prisoner. But there seemed to be no metal parts, all polymers instead. He advised her to rest, the exhaustion she felt evident in her expression, in her voice, but he could not sleep. Since the fight aboard the special, the high-speed Chinese train, much like the Japanese Tokaido bullet trains from before the night of the war, there had been little to do except monitor intelligence data coming in from Captain Hartman's forces that pursued and harassed the Soviet armies of Vladimir Karamazov. That and ponder the mystery of the increasingly frequent raids the Chinese reported on their coastal outpost, occasionally reaching as far inland as the first city. The mystery concerning the origin of these raids now seemed resolved. Some powerful undersea Soviets, their base perhaps the pre-war submarine pens at Kamran Bay in Vietnam, or perhaps some island. And it seemed evident that Karamazov had no knowledge of this Soviet force. Likely they had no knowledge of his land forces. If the two should link and form some sort of alliance, they would be irresistible. More than the immediate concern of escape for himself and Natalia, there was the greater concern of notifying the High Command of New Germany and their Icelandic and Eden Project allies, and the Chinese for that matter, of the potential for disaster, and that the timetable for a final confrontation with Karamazov's forces had to be advanced. With the addition of Chinese forces to what he had come to mentally label as the Alliance of Happenstance, the weight of numbers in Karamazov's favor was greatly diminished. But if this new Soviet force should unite with Karamazov, he thought fleetingly that they likely possessed nuclear capabilities. He left the thought unresolved, because if they did, the situation was vastly worse. Scientists of New Germany had been conducting atmospheric sampling tests for decades, and the conclusions derived from these tests seemed incontrovertible. Several average-sized nuclear detonations in the megaton range, perhaps as few as one, could trigger a second ionization effect similar to that which had all but consumed the world 5 centuries ago, shortly after the night of the war. But this time, because of the already tenuous environmental situation and the severely depleted atmosphere, all the gases associated with carbon-based life would be consumed. The planet would be forever dead, and eventually, for those who did survive in the underground redoubts like that of the Germans in Argentina, the Russians in the Ural Mountains, his own retreat in the mountains of northeast Georgia, there would be no world to return to, even to contemplate. And eventually, even if it were centuries from now, the last human life would end. Because of a bizarre interaction of the ionization effect with the Van Allen radiation belts, the Icelandics survived at the Hekla community and elsewhere in their tiny country. But not even they would be saved. John Rourke glanced again at the Rolex Submariner on his left wrist. Natalia's head rested against his chest, the weight of her body against his left arm. His arm some time ago began to stiffen, to tingle, but he did not move her. He flexed his fingers instead to restore circulation. Now she stirred.
Anna.
He used her assumed name to which they had agreed.
Go back to sleep, Anna. Nothing has changed.
She looked at him, her blue eyes still sleepy, squeezing her eyes tight shut and then opening them. She smiled at him.
Your arm must be asleep, Wolfgang.
She remembered.
My arm is fine, Anna.
He heard footsteps along the companionway, saw a fleeting shadow against one of the torpedo racks beyond their confinement on the other side of the companionway. Karenin appeared in the doorway, with him the balding man, Vznovsky, who was the interpreter. Vznovsky straightened.
I'm instructed to tell you by the Comrade Major that the submarine will soon be docking. You will accompany the Comrade Major into the city for further interrogation. Your wrists only will be bound. Should you attempt to escape, and there is no place to go or cause any disturbance, you will be shot with the Stai-20s again.
Rourke looked quizzically at Vznovsky.
Explain to them about the Stai-20.
Yes, Comrade Major. Stai-20s are our sidearms. Carbon dioxide powered, they can be used in the atmosphere or in water. They fire darts, such as those with which you were both subdued. Additional injection with the sedative contained in the darts, while a portion of the substance still remains in your bloodstreams, would prove most unpleasant and could result in permanent neuromuscular damage.
My wife and I only wish to be freed. Once freed, We would both be very interested in seeing your city. It would be pleasant to get into the night air. May my wife have her coat returned to her?
Natalia's coat caused him a moment's worry that some label or mark showing Soviet origin might have been present, until he recalled no garment she possessed, she told him once, bore any labels or manufacturer's markings. It was simpler that way, she said.
He wants his wife's coat so she'll be warm enough when they tour this city.
The two men walked away.
Perhaps their island or whatever is in the midst of a heat wave.
Perhaps. Perhaps not.
A man of Karenin's height, but more powerfully built, and with the look of a jungle cat who watched, listened, and waited to act, joined them in the companionway near the elevator bank. John Rourke had been gauging measurements for the undersea craft since their confinement in the brig began. He was not at all surprised to find elevators here. If the length of the vessel was in excess of 1,000 feet, as he surmised during the dreamlike state in which he had been brought to it, then the height from the torpedo deck to the sail had to be... The new officer moved close to Karenin to speak. Rourke listened, attempting not to appear to be.
She is a beautiful woman, Comrade Major. She should be Russian.
Despite the circumstances, Rourke almost laughed. Natalia, her wrists bound behind her, as were his, stood beside him, and she simply looked away.
Huh. The man did that to you?
The officer gestured toward Karenin's right eye.
With his hands and feet bound? Very interesting.
The two guards, two on either side of Rourke and Natalia, apparently naval personnel, judging from their uniforms, ushered them forward with shoves. As he shouldered one of the guards away to allow Natalia to enter the elevator first, he began assembling facts. Karenin was a major, and, just guessing from a comparison of uniforms, Boris Fyodorovich was a captain. Army, no more likely a modern-day Soviet equivalent of Marines. Rourke stepped inside the elevator and stood beside Natalia, watching as Karenin and the second officer entered last so as to be able to stand at the front of the elevator. Karenin's uniform was a deep blue, close-fitting jumpsuit with epaulets of a complicated braid design. The second officer's epaulets were less complicated in design. Each wore the same insignia, apparently a unit insignia, on the right collar tab. But Karenin's left collar tab insignia was more complicated in design. The silver object displayed a series of 4 interlocking circles. Boris Fyodorovich's insignia included 3. Rourke thought almost absently that the 3 interlocking circles actually seemed more aesthetically appealing from a design standpoint than the 4 circles. The interior of the elevator appeared lit by, rather than through, panels in the elevator roof. The interior was bright, polished metal, but he doubted by now it was stainless steel. The elevator moved rapidly. Rourke opened his mouth and swallowed against the pressure. He noticed Natalia looking at him.
Anna, everything will be all right.
Wolfgang!
One of the guards gestured with his Stai 20, and they both fell silent. When the elevator stopped, Rourke read the elevator panel and judged they stopped just below the sail. Karenin and the second officer exited, and Rourke and Natalia were shoved along after them into a wide corridor. There were instrument sounds forward, electronic beeping, printers, but the corridor ended abruptly about 100 feet aft. Rourke felt the corners of his mouth turning down. The corridor, it was too open to think of it as a companionway, ended so abruptly, it further confirmed his suspicions that the vessel had nuclear capabilities. Slightly ahead of the rough balance point between forward and aft sections was the logical point to position the missile tubes. Ohio-class submarines from prior to the night of the war carried 24 Trident II missiles in their tubes. Considering the vastly greater proportions of this vessel, it might well carry more than double that number. Greater nuclear firepower than many of the smaller nations of the pre-war nuclear club ever possessed, concentrated in one floating missile base. Karenin started across the corridor toward an open, watertight door. Rourke shrugged his shoulders, nodding to Natalia that it was all right, then started after him. There were stairs here, and Rourke took them after the second officer, who followed Karenin. Rourke glanced back once to see that Natalia was behind him. He saw light overhead through an open hatchway, but oddly smelled no sea breezes, no smell of night. Karenin and the second officer, Boris Fyodorovich, disappeared through the hatchway. John Rourke hesitated a moment. Then he stepped up after them and blinked his eyes in disbelief. The hatch opened onto the gap between the submarine sail, which rose perhaps 30 feet into the air, and the missile hatches. He counted the hatches quickly. 4 rows port to starboard, 15 hatches per row. John Rourke's stomach churned. But neither the height of the submarine sail nor the 60 missile tubes caused him to blink. There was no island, at least not in any conventional sense. In 5 centuries, these Russians had been busy indeed. This was where the submarine rested at port. As he looked over his left shoulder to starboard, there was a vast expanse of water, a large lagoon the size of a small lake. Fog banked at its outer edges and low clouds hung overhead, but the light was bright as day. His watch and his internal time clock said otherwise. He raised his eyes toward the sky, squinting against the light, but there was no sun. There was no sky. Above him, perhaps 100 feet distance from the water's surface, was the sea. Above him, between the sky and the sea, there was a dome. He looked aft. More submarines rested alongside a metal dock. The dock itself spread as wide and as many times as long as a football field. He was able to count 5 more submarines. Natalia stood beside him.
Mein Gott!
Karenin and the second officer stood a few feet from them. Rourke stepped closer to the 2 Russian officers so he could see around the sail and forward. This craft was the first in line at the docks. But where the dock ended, perhaps 100 feet ahead of the bow of the vessel on the deck of which Rourke and Natalia stood, there was an opening leading beyond the dock. As he watched, what he assumed to be a mini-sub, perhaps half the length of the old skipjack-class subs of the late 1950s, sailed through an opening in the dome. A massive transparent dome replaced the sail, giving the craft the appearance of a marine life form with a solitary eye rather than a machine made by men. 2 fins cut the water's surface. The vessel rode low and menacing in the water. The entrance through which it came drew his attention. It was a vast hollow hemisphere, an opening cut into a vastly larger hemisphere or dome. John Rourke's eyes followed the surface of the dome upward. The dome immediately over his head, the artificial sky, joined it. The actual height of the larger dome lost where the smaller dome and then the sea obscured it.
Wolfgang?
There is nothing we can do now except see the Torres Zaitana. I am here with you.
Karenin started walking, the second officer beside him. The guards fell in and flanked Rourke and Natalia. A solitary guard walked behind them as they followed Karenin and the second officer across the deck toward a long gangplank. On each side of the gangplank ran 3 rows of chain. The chain rows there for safety, one perhaps a foot above the level of the gangplank, another 2 feet higher, a third at almost chest level. Karenin and Boris Fyodorovich started down the gangplank. Rourke fell in behind them, Natalia beside him. Because of the width of the gangplank, the flanking guards fell in behind Rourke and Natalia. For a moment, Rourke considered hurtling Natalia over the gangplank side, then jumping after her. But there was only the dock, unless something lurked behind the mists at the far side of the lagoon. Where could they go? And their hands were bound with the plastic cords which seemed escape-proof without a knife. Rourke studied the composition of the hull of the submarine. Prior to the night of the war, the Soviets used a type of rubberized coating on the hulls of their underwater vessels. He wondered if this craft, like the old Soviet submarines, was double-hulled. As he mused over these concerns, he listened to the seemingly unguarded conversation of the Russian officers.
The woman is very beautiful. But do you think if they really are married, that she...
Karenin raised his hand. Karenin turned off from the docks into what appeared to be a large tube. It was a tunnel. Everything here seemed to be prefabricated, modular. The tube was of some transparent material. As they walked, Rourke could see on both sides of the tube what appeared to be a similar lagoon, missing only the mists that enshrouded the outer limits of the larger one. The lagoon seemed alive with more dome-eyed mini-subs. The lagoons, he knew, would be kept at their level by air pressure, the air trapped beneath the domes. Early types of diving bells used such a system. But in the early diving bells, as the air was consumed, the water level rose. To maintain an all but constant level for these lagoons here, air pressure would have to be kept constant. The need for the fleet became suddenly obvious. The mini-subs, the larger vessels. There was some other enemy. The Chinese had no ability to pursue the Russians into the sea. No power on Earth existed, of which John Rourke knew, that possessed the ability to threaten these Russians in their underwater complex. But the fleet, there was indeed some other enemy. Regardless of the material used for the construction of the protective dome or domes, the material would be vulnerable to destruction, and the pressure of the sea against the material would be immense. The slightest crack could start it. A hole would seal the fate of all who resided here. The Soviet fleet, and perhaps what he saw here was only some small portion of it, would guard the perimeter of the complex against attackers. And, granted that assumptions were dangerous, it was likely that whoever these enemies of the Soviets were, they would be potential allies. They left the tube into a still larger tube with walkways on either side and vehicles, official no doubt, parked along either curbside. Some type of electric cars with gull-wing doors. Rourke followed the younger officer beneath the door opening and inside, sitting in the rear seat, Natalia beside him, a guard on either side of them, the other guards on a rear-facing jump seat. Karenin and the other two officers were in the forward-facing seat in the center, a single-seat cockpit at the left front. The gull wing on the curbside whooshed closed. The driver consulted what appeared to be a very interesting electronic instrument panel. Then the car pulled away from the curb and into the street. The dreamlike experience after being shot with the Stai 20 occurred within the capsule, and although the capsule could easily transport injured personnel away from a land-based battlefield to a vessel beneath the sea, it was more likely that the capsules were used for prisoner transfer. He heard the Chinese agent Han telling of the disappearance of some Chinese after the mysterious attacks. If the Soviet fleet were a defense against some other underwater power, the capsules might well be used for prisoner transport in this context as well. But did prisoners survive here? Were there potential allies here he could somehow make use of? The vehicle was definitely electric or something using a system other than internal combustion. The ride was so smooth he barely noticed the vehicle turn. To their right was the sea, a portion of the dome perhaps 50 yards from the road surface, enclosed a greenway with trees, flowers, and shrubs growing in abundance. He noticed older women kneeling and tending the plantings. The women all were dressed the same. They wore medium blue tunics and medium blue slacks, scarves of the same color tied over their hair. To the left, he noticed several younger people, men and women, dressed almost identically, all in the blue collarless tunics and slacks. The men wore long-billed baseball caps, the women scarves. Beyond that walkway, another dome rose, and beyond its surface, Rourke saw water. More vessels of the Soviet underwater fleet, or something else. The vehicle turned again. Three vast domes suddenly swung into view as the vehicle moved away from them, one central and two the same size or slightly smaller. Clouds hung near the height of the central dome. The car continued its travel, and now they were no longer inside a dome, but rather in a wide structure with a gently curved overhead and gently curved bulkheads, like the belly of a massive ship. The guard, over which Rourke leaned to stare through the left side gullwing's window section, elbowed Rourke in the ribcage, and Rourke leaned back. He stared ahead now. Vehicles of all descriptions were parked beyond an energy barrier similar to that at the opening of the submarine's brig. The vehicle slowed to a stop. Karenin passed papers through a window beside him to the shorter of two blue-uniformed guards. Their uniforms were like Karenin's, though fit less well and showed different rank. Something else caught Rourke's eye. Each of the guards was only armed with what appeared to be one of the Stai 20 pistols. He logged away this detail as well. Were conventional firearms not allowed inside the domes? The papers were returned. Karenin casually, but with style, returned a salute. The vehicle started ahead, the energy barrier turned off, crackling slightly as it reactivated behind them. Rourke watched through the vehicle's rear window. The vehicles he saw parked were more easily identifiable now as the gullwing glided past them. He could see armored personnel carriers, massive, flat, their wheels enormous, their color gray. More personnel in uniform moved about here, attending the vehicles or merely standing beside them, engaged in conversation. At the end of this tunnel, through which they now moved, was another dome. Rourke squinted against the light as the gullwing moved out beneath it. It was landscaped beautifully here, Structures rose out of tree-lined squares. They rose several stories toward the height of the dome. There were smaller domes on either side, quadrants of their hemispheres just visible toward the edge of the tunnel they just left. The vehicle stopped beside a rounded curb abutting a horseshoe-shaped driveway. The doors opened on both sides this time, and as Karenin and the other two officers got out, Rourke was tugged toward the driver's side door, Natalia toward the opposite door. Rourke stood in the light. It wasn't sunshine, but felt warm to the skin. He squinted against it now even harder and looked skyward. The building before which the vehicle had parked stood a full 10 stories high. There were a half dozen other buildings beneath the dome, none so tall as this. All of them appeared constructed of a prefabricated material. Their color, a neutral tan, pleased the eye, perhaps because of the landscaping that set them off. The guard gestured toward the building. Rourke nodded. It would have been easy enough to kill the man, but Natalia was on the other side of the vehicle. And where would they go, even if they could escape? Before escape could be considered, he had to know more. Rourke stepped onto the curb where Karenin waited. Rourke wondered suddenly why the balding interpreter had not been brought along. Karenin started toward the large, glass-looking double doors fronting the building. Over the doors, Rourke read the Cyrillic script, Command and General Staff Headquarters, Pacific Soviet Socialist Republic. If the marble were a synthetic, it not only had the appearance of the real thing, but also the cold of it. Rourke's fingers moved away from the gray and black pillar. Karenin alone conferred with the three men at the long, table-like desk at the far end of the vaulted room. Behind their seats, a familiar device hung on the wall. The hammer and sickle of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, with the initials CCCP in gold, or some similar metal, beneath it. Captain Feodorovich approached Rourke, his hands on his hips. He spoke in Russian. Rourke pretended ignorance.
I know that you understand me, and that you will not acknowledge that you do. I have seen a man just like you. He had your height, your coloring, your hair, even dressed similar to you. A brother, perhaps? He fought like no man I have ever seen. He was brave in the extreme, and because of that, I will tell you this. Comrade Major Karenin will have your woman, wife or not. That means that whatever befalls you, you will die in the last. Use this information for whatever value it may hold to you.
He turned and walked away. Michael, Rourke almost said aloud. His son. He closed his eyes for an instant. Despite Michael's abilities, and Paul's as well, despite anything, there would be no help coming. He opened his eyes. The guards were moving toward him and Natalia. Rourke waited. They gestured for them to move ahead, toward Karenin and the three seated men. Rourke moved ahead, his eyes focusing on each of the faces in turn. They all seemed piteously alike, dour-faced, balding, and paunchy. All that was missing was for one of them to hold his hands over his eyes, the other his ears, the third his mouth. The heels of Rourke's combat boots clicked on the marble, or marble-like floor, Natalia's boot heels clicking more loudly. Both of them stopped a yard or so before the triumvirate.
Captain, you'll translate the tribunal's activities to this point for the accused.
A woman seated to the right of the triumvirate, an officer dressed identically to her male counterparts, her hair nearly as short as theirs, rose and stood at attention as guards fit headphones to Rourke and Natalia.
We have heard Major Karenin's evidence. You are both charged with multiple counts of murder, espionage, and crimes of intent against the Soviet people. Since the evidence against you is so overwhelming, there is no purpose in entering a plea. Have you anything to say in your behalf?
Rourke stepped a pace forward. The triumvirate donned headphones to listen to the translation of his remarks.
My wife and I were walking along the beach. She went on ahead. She was set upon by soldiers under the command of this man. I came to her rescue. We were subdued, then kidnapped and taken aboard one of your vessels, where my wife and I were both subjected to threats of violence and forced to disrobe for unnecessary and demeaning searches of our persons. We are German citizens on a peaceful mission of exploration in search of remaining pockets of civilization following the great war between the Russian people and the people of America. We come in peace, seeking only knowledge. We were armed only for our own protection against whatever unknown dangers lay before us in our quest.
He paused to allow the transition to catch up.
We were both given intensive training in the means of self-defense and in various other skills needed for long-term survival. We encountered the Chinese. I presume they are your enemies. They spoke of warriors raiding their cities, and I presume your people are those of whom they spoke. We have no taste for warfare, my wife and I. We have come in peace. You are evidently possessed of great knowledge here. You are fortunate indeed. If you wish to make formal contact with the German people, we would be honored, and the contact could serve to the mutual advantage of our peoples. If you do not, we only ask to be allowed to return to the surface, reunite with our few comrades, and continue our explorations in peace, someday returning to our loved ones in Germany, to our colleagues. You need have no fears that by some means any slight knowledge we may have obtained of your civilization here would eventually work to your undoing. No power on the surface of Earth could reach your homeland, nor certainly pose any threat to your homeland whatsoever. Please, let us return to the surface in peace.
The man at the center of the triumvirate looked to Karenin as the translation finished.
Comrade Major, is it possible they are indeed whom they claim to be, or are you convinced otherwise?
I am convinced, Comrade Chairman, that this man and woman lie. Based upon field intelligence reports of Captain Fyodorovich, it would appear that several people of the white race have allied themselves with our enemies, the Chinese. Their origin can be only one place. They can only be cleverly placed agents of our enemies at Midwake, Comrade Chairman.
Rourke's mind raced. Midwake? Midwake? Karenin stared at Natalia, then at Rourke.
They must be fully interrogated, Comrade Chairman. With your permission, I wish to undertake the task personally.
Take them away, Major.
The three men of the Triumvirate, as one, cast down their eyes to study the paperwork on their massive desk. Rourke attempted to resist as they were taken from the great marble hall, but a knife, his knife, had been placed at Natalia's throat, and he submitted. They did not return to the artificial sunlight, but were taken down a long flight of stairs, the smell at the base of the stairs a mingling of dampness, sweat, and human fear. With a knife still held to Natalia's throat, Rourke, his wrists still bound, was placed on an examining table. His legs were spread apart and his ankles were shackled to each side of the table. Then the bindings at his wrists were cut and his arms shackled over his head, spread wide to the upper corners of the table. The table was of immense proportions and made of stainless steel or some similar substance. The female officer who served as translator before the triumvirate accompanied them, and her face seemed to be growing paler by the second. Karenin spoke and she translated his words expressionlessly, but Rourke watched Karenin's eyes.
Perhaps you believe it will be possible to defeat the techniques we use. You will soon find you are mistaken. In the interests of being humane, I shall warn you that resistance is futile. You will spare yourself considerable misery if you speak now.
The triumvirate sent the courtroom translator to assist in the interrogation, and she worked swiftly to interpret for John and Natalia. Rourke focused his attention on remembering the way to say fuck you in German. He heard Natalia's voice. Her voice was higher pitched than normal, but otherwise firm.
We know nothing that would interest you. We will be happy to answer any questions, Major. It is just that you choose arbitrarily to believe that our answers are lies. They are not.
They were lies, of course. And the lies they told were an integral part of the one faint hope Rourke clung to, that the torture session would be unrewarding to Karenin and he would think them incapable of further resistance and, for one split second, be sloppy enough that he, John Rourke, or Natalia could get to a weapon. That meant surviving what would come next and clinging to the lies. Karenin ignored Natalia's remarks.
Shackle her to the other table.
Rourke knew that for each of them, the hardest pain to endure would be that inflicted on the other.
We can make up lies, Major, but you will see through them. We only have one truth to tell, and we have told it to you.
Karenin smiled as he listened to the translation, then turned to the translator.
I somehow feel that both of you believe you have endured such treatment as I offer now before. You may believe this, but you have never known pain or suffering such as the devices in this room are capable of inducing.
As she relayed the message, the female officer's complexion turned slightly green. No drugs then, Rourke thought. That was a plus for being able to maintain the lie. To reveal he was American, and that she was once a major in the KGB, but turned to the cause of freedom, would have invited no less torture and possibly instant execution. To reveal the war raging on the surface were the democratic allies of New Germany in Argentina, the Icelandics, Eden Base, in what was once the United States, and the Chinese, the current enemies of these Russians, fought the Soviet forces under the command of Marshal Vladimir Karamazov, Natalia's husband, would only precipitate the total destruction of the Allies, the final suppression of freedom.
We shall now begin. When you feel compelled by your own suffering or the suffering of your comrade to have the procedures brought to conclusion, all that is necessary is that you tell the truth.
Metal blocks were brought to the table by one of the technicians present in the sub-level chamber. The technician placed the blocks on either side of Rourke's head, as two of the guards held Rourke's head rigidly with their hands. At the far edge of his peripheral vision, Rourke saw similar blocks being placed beside Natalia's head. Switches were activated on the blocks, bands of steel or some similar substance rising out of each block. Rourke felt their coldness against the skin of his temples and forehead. The technician stepped away. Rourke could not move his head, the blocks apparently locked magnetically to the table. Karenin's voice sounded almost casual.
You are perhaps not familiar with the use of ultrasonics. Research began centuries ago into the process by which high-frequency sound waves could be utilized to control the human mind and body. Simply by adjusting frequency and target area in the brain, we can make you do anything we wish.
Karenin nodded. The pain in Rourke's head started, then fiercer pain, still in his back, on either side of his spine. The female translator turned her face away in disgust. Rourke's body was shaking.
The woman you call your wife, why don't we see how responsive she is to direct sexual stimuli, Translate, Lieutenant.
Rourke, at the edge of his peripheral vision, saw Natalia's body begin slowly to move. Her eyelids fluttered. Her lower torso began moving rapidly now, her back arching.
Humiliation is even more effective than pain. But we can cause pain.
Karenin gave a gesture with his hand. He turned to the translator, Rourke, barely able to see him.
Hopefully, they both have strong hearts.
This was a well-practiced routine, Rourke realized. Suddenly, he felt it, a terrible headache behind his eyes, and then something like a vice beginning to clamp ever more tightly around his chest. They were giving him a coronary occlusion. He tried to control his breathing, to tell his mind that this was all unreal. Rourke's body lurched as the vice tightened and his lungs could no longer suck air, his left arm numb with pain. Natalia's body went rigid. Rourke wanted to shout to them that he was a doctor and that in seconds he knew Natalia would die. Her normally pale skin was ashen, her mouth wide, gasping for breath. Rourke's body shook. He was telling himself these men who were doing this knew their jobs and would know just how far to go before death became inevitable. He was losing consciousness, the numbness in his left arm replaced with pain almost more intense than the pain in his chest. Rourke tried to speak. He could only gasp for breath. And suddenly, the pain was gone. His body sagged downward. A green wash replaced his vision. Was this natural or something induced by their machinery?
I could have let both of you die or just one of you. Now let us see what fears can be dredged out of your minds. I wish to see both of you consumed with fear.
The translator trembled as she quickly relayed Karenin's words. Rourke felt a sudden relaxing of his body, almost a calmness in his brain. He wondered if he were dead. He had read out-of-body experiences of people who technically died on the operating table. He felt himself floating over the chamber where he and Natalia were being tortured. He could see himself, see Natalia, see Karenin standing almost directly under him. See the frightened and nauseated female translator. See Feodorovich in the far corner. It was a look of calm on his face, a look that somehow seemed strange to him. Natalia was screaming, her body twisting, writhing, her face contorted in agony. John Rourke tried to move, to reach down to touch her. He could not move. Whatever they were doing to him had stopped. Karenin suddenly had a blowtorch in his hand. How did he get it? He was walking toward Natalia, there on the table. He started moving the blowtorch toward her face. Rourke tried to shout. He couldn't shout, couldn't make a sound. He tried to close his eyes for an instant, to think. His eyes would not close. He could not think. Karenin moved the torch closer. The blowtorch touched at her eyes, and they were gone. Flames licked up, tongues of yellow and orange, but tinged still with the blue of her eyes. Then her face was consumed with flames, and Rourke felt tears welling up in his eyes. Now there were tables beyond the one on which Natalia had died. He could smell her flesh still burning as Karenin moved on to the next table. Rourke's wife, Sarah, was there, pregnant with their baby. Karenin brought the blowtorch toward her, and then her clothes were gone, and she was lying there on the cold table, naked, and he could feel her coldness as Karenin touched the blowtorch to her abdomen. Rourke kept trying to scream. He could not. Sarah's body was aflame, and he could see the baby, on fire, the flames consuming her, consuming them both. He saw soldiers strapping Annie, Michael, and Paul to their tables. Rourke was paralyzed. He commanded his legs and arms to respond, but they would not. He realized that if he spoke the truth, at least Annie and Paul and Michael would be saved. But he couldn't speak. A single phrase in English would do it, and Karenin, who was bringing the torch nearer and nearer to Annie's long, dark, honey-blonde hair, would stop the slaughter. Rourke tried to shout.
Annie!
Everything stopped, frozen, and the flames became the mists shrouding the edges of the lagoon where the submarine surfaced, and John Rourke's body was drenched in sweat. Natalia's screaming had stopped. John Rourke opened his eyes. Karenin turned to Feodorovich.
At least we know that Anna is really the woman's name, he called to her in his fear. Do not translate, Lieutenant. Sit down over there.
Comrade Major, you have nothing beyond provoking this man to call out his wife's name. You do not even know she is his wife. Use the drugs, I suggest.
I do not wish to use drugs, Captain. You are dismissed.
As you wish, Comrade Major.
The ultrasonics are having little effect. They are both very strong, very much alike. We will weaken them.
Rourke found Natalia at the edge of his peripheral vision. Her eyes were closed and her body was still. John Rourke closed his own eyes. Karenin approached Natalia.
I admire your stamina, your courage. But this will be used to bring about the end I desire. The man, you see him clearly?
John Rourke, stripped of his clothing, wrists bound, was suspended from a large hook at the center of a 2-meter diameter capsule formed of something like plexiglass. Natalia's own hands were bound behind her, and she felt them trembling. She nodded that she saw him. 3/4 of the capsule's circumference were bounded by the sea. Distorted by the plexiglass-like substance, she could view sea creatures, bizarre in shape, some almost transparent, some almost luminous. She realized this Soviet underwater complex had to be at some tremendous depth.
That is a decompression chamber of sorts. You may be familiar with some of its uses, but we have a special use for it. We will slowly begin to equalize the air pressure to the pressure of the sea outside the wall of the capsule. As we do, your husband, or whoever he is, will be crushed to death. We used the ultrasonics to render him unconscious so he could not resist us when he was placed in the chamber. But now...
Natalia looked at Karenin. Karenin gestured to a technician. The man stepped inside the open airlock of the capsule, approached John Rourke's suspended, naked body, and wiped John's upper left arm near the tricep. He placed a gun-shaped object against the muscle. She imagined it was something like adrenaline to revive him. Blood trickled from the tricep, and the technician wiped it away neatly, then left the capsule. The airlock sealed.
Now he will revive in order that he may be aware of his death agonies. But you have the power to stop this. We will increase the pressure by 10%, and you can watch his torment. We will then increase by 2% at a time. He is very strong, despite the ordeal you have both passed through. He could suffer for hours. But he will eventually reach a point that even if the capsule is gradually depressurized to normal atmosphere, too much internal damage will have been done, and he will inevitably die, or perhaps only be paralyzed. But if you tell the truth to me in time, he will live, at least for now, undamaged, without pain. And if, after the use of truth drugs, I am satisfied with your story. Even if he is executed, he will die quickly. I give you my word as an officer.
Karenin signaled to the technicians beside the airlock. And for the first time, Natalia saw the controls for the capsule. One of the technicians began adjusting a diode readout, then pressed a button. Natalia Anastasia Tyamarovna, Major, Committee for State Security of the Soviet Union, ceased weeping. No more tears remained to her. Her eyes only burned and her head ached. She had been forced to stand perfectly erect and perfectly still for what she judged internally as at least an hour, watching as slowly the pressure on the body of the man she worshipped increased. He had long since stopped screaming with the pain. But he was conscious, his face contorting in agony, his body suspended by his wrists, twisting, twitching, as if being hammered at by invisible fists. His hands were swollen and purpling, and the veins in his upper arms and forearms were distended, purpling as well.
He is stronger than I thought. But as we increase by another 2%, I think you will see something spectacular.
The translator's flat intonation recalled a shell-shocked soldier. Natalia closed her eyes. She wanted to cry, but there was nothing left in her. The fears that their ultrasonics engendered in her showed her John Rourke dying at Karenin's hands, at Vladimir's, her husband's, hands. In the vision, she stood totally alone in the world. Everywhere she looked, John Rourke lay dead. And then she saw herself as a very old woman, totally alone. She watched now as she knew she must. John's body twitched. Blood began trickling from both his nostrils and his head lolled back.
He will die. Or worse, soon.
A thoroughly drained, deadly calm Natalia turned to Karenin.
I am Major Natalia Anastasia Tyamarovna of the Committee for State Security of the Soviet Union. I am the wife of Marshal Vladimir Karamazov, leader of the rebel armies of the Soviet state, and operating now in China as part of a continuing war against the few surviving Americans, the government of New Germany and Argentina, and other allied democracies. My husband would sacrifice anything to get me back.
Ah, he loves you.
He wishes me dead because he is like you, an animal who feeds on pain, evil incarnate. And I chose to fight for what was right and reject the lies I had been taught from my birth. I am the niece of a true hero of the Soviet Union, General Ishmael Varakov, Commanding General, North American Army of Occupation, following the night of the war. I am the most valuable prize you will ever obtain. Release him at once and give him the necessary medical attention, or I will find a way to kill myself, no matter how well you guard me.
You will freely submit to drug therapy?
Yes, but only if you release him immediately and see to his injuries.
Who is this man if he is not your husband?
Release him now!
First, who is he? Or there is no arrangement. Comrade Major Tyamarovna.
Natalia closed her eyes. She would focus all her mind on one lie only, and perhaps she could save him.
He is a German officer of intelligence. His name is Wolfgang. Colonel Wolfgang...
She searched for a name. She remembered the American soup.
Wolfgang Heinz.
Bring the pressure to safe entry level and attend to the German officer, quickly. See to it that he is given the best medical attention.
Karenin's hands went to her shoulders, his fingertips gouging into her flesh beneath the fabric of her black jumpsuit.
If you lie to me, Major Tyamarovna, his death and yours will be more horrible than anything you could possibly imagine.
The German J-7V aircraft's subtle droning lulled her to sleep, and she dreamed. Annie Rourke Rubinstein sat staring out the window now, the J-7V coming in for its final approach at the boundaries of a strange city. It was called the First City, and was the disputed capital of China. Her hands balled tightly over her shawl, and she stared at them. She released the shawl, folded it neatly, and placed it on the seat beside her. She crossed her legs, arranging the ankle-length full skirt. It was so dark a gray as to be almost black. She stared into the dark material and recalled her dream. In her vivid dream, she saw her father, John Rourke, and Natalia Tyamarovna. They lay on tables of some shiny metal, and they were being hurt. She felt pain. She felt Natalia in a terrible, unending loneliness. When she woke from the dream, Annie knew her father and Natalia were in the greatest danger of their lives. The death was very near to them, almost touching them. She wanted very badly for Paul to hold her very tight for very long. Paul would not be waiting for her after she disembarked from the German aircraft. There would only be strangers, strangers told to treat her well, to protect her. Paul, her brother Michael, and some small force would be searching for her father and Natalia. She had to contact them, tell Paul and Michael about her dream. She closed her eyes, her hands clenched tightly in her lap. Her mother was at tea with Madame Jokli, the president of Lidveldid Island. She asked to see her mother privately. Sarah Rourke went with her to the little garden off the library.
What is it, Annie?
I talked to Paul through a radio link the German commander set up for me. Daddy and Natalia, they're missing.
She folded her mother into her arms, her shawl falling from her shoulders.
What?
I don't know much about it, Mama, but there were signs of a fight and they're just gone. Paul and Michael and some of the Chinese are going to go look for them. I said I was coming, if you don't need me here.
Her mother held her at arm's length, and Sarah Rourke's eyes were tear-rimmed.
If you think you can help,
You can't go, Mama. Not with the baby.
Sarah Rourke's fingers splayed over her abdomen. She took Annie into her arms. Annie looked out the window as the J-7V in vertical mode touched down. She picked up her shawl from the seat beside her. She placed it on her lap. Beneath the shawl was her pistol belt, the Detonic Scoremaster 45 in one holster, the Beretta 92F military 9mm in the other. She undid her safety belt and stood up, taking up the pistol belt and securing it just below her natural waist. Annie raised her left foot to the level of the seat and hitched up her skirt and slip. When her father returned from the retreat, he brought her a present. He told her it was one of the finest and most practical knives made before the night of the war. He gave her a special sheath for it, patterned after the Bianchi leg holster, but designed to carry a knife rather than a gun. It was secured both above and below her black-stockinged left calf, a cold steel tanto. She let her skirt drop as she lowered her leg. She picked up her shawl, the co-pilot of the J-7V smiling at her as he passed to open the exit hatch. She slung her M16 crossbody beneath her right arm and started from the aircraft. Natalia Anastasia Tyamarovna sat in the chair. It was quite comfortable, really, or perhaps it was only her fatigue and lack of sleep and the tension that had temporarily, she knew, eased. She saw John Rourke, as she had been brought here to Marine Spetsnaz headquarters in the same dome as the headquarters building and its torture chamber. He lay resting quietly in the infirmary. She checked his chart. She knew enough of medicine from her own training at the KGB's Chicago school before the night of the war, and additional training when once she posed as a nurse in order to perform a termination, to realize that, according to the chart at least, John was being given appropriate care. Vitamin shots, a glucose IV, and mild sedation for rest. He seemed to have suffered no permanent ill effects. She bent over his bed and touched her lips to his forehead, then left with Karenin. The major's office was very personal-looking. A Chinese assault rifle on the wall behind his desk, photographs of training companies along the walls, trophies, medals in glass cases. The medical technician, a woman, was very gentle as she placed the IV.
Does that feel comfortable, Comrade Major?
The IV would regulate the flow of the truth drugs into her bloodstream.
Yes, thank you.
Natalia asked to be allowed to change from her perspiration-soaked, sand-filled clothes. She asked for a dress. Dresses did not exist here. She received the blue uniform the civilians wore, or at least she assumed they were civilians. She showered, but there was no such thing as a hairdryer. She toweled her hair as dry as she could and refused to wear the blue scarf that was part of the female civilian uniform. Her shoulders and neck felt damp from her hair, and she was slightly cold now. And already she could feel the truth drug starting to take effect. She focused on John Rourke, Wolfgang Heinz. She would protect John's identity. Protect.
You claim that you are more than 5 centuries old.
She had to be patient with him, Natalia reminded herself on one level of consciousness.
Of course not. We did not age in the cryogenic chambers, Major.
Explain to me what you remember of meeting this John Rourke, whom you later joined. Why is he not here?
John Rourke is consulting with the German military high command concerning my husband's strategic posture. You must remember that John Rourke is unofficially considered the leader in the war effort against my husband and his armies. He is the man to whom they all look for courage and inspiration. If he were here...
The lighting device found on the person of this Colonel Wolfgang Heinz, who accompanied you, it bears the Roman letters J-T-R, and the word, I am told, might be pronounced Zippo.
Many of the Germans still smoke.
What is that?
The small cylinders of leaf material wrapped in white paper, which I carried. They are cigarettes. I could use one now. The things Colonel Heinz carried are cigars.
Her head ached when she thought of John Rourke, Wolfgang Heinz.
You light them and inhale the smoke into your lungs.
That is insane.
It was a habit long years ago, and many of us still cling to it.
What do the Roman letters and the word Zippo refer to?
There was a terrible pain behind her eyes. She had been taught to resist drugs. These were strange drugs.
Zippo is the manufacturer's name, and the initials identify the lighter more specifically.
To defeat a truth drug, one told the truth as much as possible, she had learned. How long ago?
All right. Your guns, why do they have these birds on the barrels? I am told they are American symbols.
They were given to me by Sam Chambers, who was the president of United States II. It was a government formed after the death of the American president during the night of the war or just afterward. It was headquartered near the border between Texas and Louisiana in the United States.
The more truth she could tell, the better.
How did you meet this John Rourke?
I met John Rourke after the night of the war. There was a war. No one told us who initiated it. There was an ultimatum from the American president to our premier.
This Chambers person?
No. He was president after the other president died.
She had to cling to the thread.
There was an ultimatum for us to leave Pakistan. We invaded from Afghanistan. Someone ordered the missiles to be launched. We were never told who first launched, the Americans or ourselves. And after the night of the war, my uncle, General Varakov, was given command of the Army of Occupation, and he headquartered in Chicago, a city in the midsection of the United States. My husband was given command of the KGB for the United States. They never got along.
Her uncle and her husband had hated one another. Her uncle a decent man, a good soldier, a loyal communist.
Vladimir had a list of people he wished killed or incarcerated, among them Sam Chambers, who was the only surviving member of the presidential cabinet and the next man in line to become the president. My uncle wished him captured alive so that negotiations could get underway to stop the violence, because there was always resistance to us from the first. The American people enjoyed a constitutional right to keep and bear arms for their own defense, and we encountered armed resistance to our regime at every turn.
Civilians possessed arms.
Civilians fought for their country and did themselves proud in the end.
How did you meet Rourke?
I went into the desert with a man named Yuri, who was very adept at portraying Americans. We were set upon by men I later came to call brigands, outlaws. They killed Yuri and severely injured me. I killed them. John Rourke and his friend Paul Rubinstein were traveling from New Mexico to Georgia. Those are states in the United States, by motorcycle, and they found me after my vehicle became disabled. I would have died otherwise.
This Rourke is an American, I know. This Rubinstein?
Oh, a fine American, Major.
How did they travel when you were discovered?
They traveled by motorcycle. A two-wheeled machine.
Why did they travel during a war?
Society does not stop because of a war. John was searching for his wife and children, and Paul was helping him. They became friends after the crash of the airplane.
Airplane? You said they traveled by means of these motorcycles.
On the night of the war, John was in Canada, a country north of the United States. He was trying to return to his family in Georgia, and the airplane was diverted, and the pilot and crew were unable to land the aircraft. And John did it. In New Mexico, the airplane was diverted that far. Then they started to cross the country to get back to Georgia. And Paul had a family in Florida.
And this is how Rourke and this other man found you?
In Texas. They took care of me, took me with them. I think John knew all the time that I was a Soviet agent.
He found incriminating documents?
He was in the Central Intelligence Agency before that.
What is this?
The CIA was like the KGB in a way.
Ah, then he arrested you.
She shook her head, and it made her head swim a little.
Oh, he helped me. He treated my wound. He restored my body. He shared everything with me. He and Paul.
By messenger, the chairman, leader of the First City, asked Annie to join him for breakfast. In her suite of rooms, there were closets, mostly empty until she hung in them the few things she brought with her, a few extra blouses, an extra skirt. The other things, underwear, stockings, the cleaning kit for her handguns and her rifle, the whetstone for her knife, she placed in the drawers of one of the two lovely dressers in the bedroom. At the chairman's prompting, women arrived, their arms loaded with clothing. Annie had seen things like these in the videotapes her father kept at the retreat, in picture books as a little girl, and to a degree among the very few pretty things Natalia brought with her to the retreat. The women in charge told Annie to select however many or few items she wished. Annie found it hard to comprehend so many things because all of her adult life, with the exception of the time spent in Iceland, she made all her own clothing. And the habit remained. In Iceland, she began making her own clothing again. She settled on 6 very pretty dresses, reasoning that to take less would be rude and that there would never be any hope of taking more with her.
Pretty.
Annie stood in front of the full-length mirror now, studying herself. She had never seen herself look so sophisticated, she decided. It was a chongsan, if she remembered the word right, of green silk. At least, it felt like silk. It was sleeveless, high-necked, and came to the middle of her calves. But there was a deep slit up the side, halfway up her left thigh. The stockings she wore were also silk. So was the underwear. Natalia had silk underwear, the only time Annie had ever seen silk. She arranged her hair atop her head, held in place with 2 things that looked like thin spikes, had large gemstones at one end, and were very pretty. The stones were also green. She wore no jewelry other than her wedding ring and her watch. She took off the watch, too mannish. She would never take Paul's ring from her finger.
Just a minute!
The one problem with the dress was that there was no place to hide a gun. She couldn't get used to the idea of a purse, never owned one in her adult life.
Shit!
The gun belt, aside from being bad manners, would look terrible with the green silk dress. If they wanted to kill her, they could have killed her while she slept, or they could poison her at breakfast. She opened one of the dresser drawers and put her gun belt and the leg sheath for the Tonto inside and closed it. Her father would be angry with her for going unarmed. She closed her eyes. There had been another dream. Her father was calm, she knew, and Natalia was struggling. She tried contacting Paul or Michael. There was no way to contact them, she learned. Their radios were turned off. Annie walked to the door, put a smile on her face, lipstick tasted funny, and opened the door. It was the chairman himself. She had seen him from a distance shortly after she arrived.
If I may speak with such boldness, you are very beautiful, Mrs. Rubinstein.
And you are very flattering. There has been no word from my husband or my brother?
One can only assume, Mrs. Rubinstein, that all goes well and our attempt to penetrate the encampment of the Soviet leader and resolve this perplexing situation concerning the whereabouts of your father and the Russian woman who is his companion.
One can only assume, sir.
And now, please join me. It is a rare thing for me to breakfast with a woman so beautiful.
As Annie moved to the door, she made up her mind. If there was no news by midday, she would go after Paul and Michael herself. She could not take another dream.